I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. This year on Palm Sunday, we had a conversation back home in Smithville where I ended up explaining to my children a little bit about the traditions of Palm Sunday in Christianity. It all goes back to New Testament accounts of people welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem by strewing palm branches before him as he rode into the city. And you would think that that would be explanation enough for why Palm Sunday is observed in modern times by Christian believers and how the commemoration got its name in the first place. But no, actually. After talking with my children about this, I started mulling over how odd the whole episode seems to be from a modern perspective. If you want to honor somebody, why would you drop branches out in front of that person? It seems counterproductive to put a possible obstacle down in the way. And why a palm branch? Were palms just nearby and convenient? Maybe somebody named Simon said to somebody named Jonas, "Hey, grab me a branch." And Jonas said, "Okay, I guess this palm branch will do." Well, this gets into the realm of cultural and literary studies and history because there probably are answers to such questions. Every story you and I have heard from the Bible happened, if it happened, in some sort of environment. There were surroundings, there was society, there was context. So back to this business with the palm branches. I have since learned that long before Jesus was even born, and not exclusively in the Hebrew world, the palm was highly symbolic. You can trace its significance back for centuries before Jesus Christ in places like Greece, Rome, Assyria, Egypt, and the symbolic function of the palm in these places was connected to themes of triumph, victory, and also peace. So Palm Sunday, with the Jesus story, that didn't just happen as a fluke. My hypothetical Simon and my hypothetical Jonas would have perhaps concluded their conversation with Simon being handed a palm branch by Jonas and Simon saying, "Perfect, that's just the thing." He would not have said, "Oh, I guess that'll do." Well, today we are going to enjoy a conversation with somebody who has worked diligently to bring context to the accounts we have of the life and times of Jesus. Jean-Pierre Isbouts is on the faculty of the Fielding Graduate University in Santa Barbara. He's a scholar in the humanities, also an award-winning filmmaker and screenwriter who has turned his camera lens toward many of his research interests. These include biblical archaeology, Renaissance Florence, and 19th century Europe. Isbouts is so many things, it's hard to tally up just his interests, to say nothing of his accomplishments. He has actually directed stars such as Leonard Nimoy, Charlton Heston, and Dick Van Dyke. He's a musicologist also who has been deeply involved in the production of music. He's a highly successful author. His first major book from 2007, titled The Biblical World, published by National Geographic Books, and 5 years later a volume titled In the Footsteps of Jesus, A Chronicle of His Life and the Origins of Christianity. He's with us on the line, Jean-Pierre Isbouts. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
It's a pleasure.
I'm very interested in, maybe you've had the kind of experience I've had, where I'm watching some kind of a video presentation that is supposed to represent a scene from the life of Jesus, and you see the costumes, and you see the way the people made the hair for the camera, and then you see maybe the domestic setting of a family in Bethlehem or Jerusalem or Nazareth or Galilee, wherever, and you just look at that movie and you say, "Huh, I have no idea if that's the way things should look." Have you been perplexed by the cinematography and the videography of these kinds of scenes that are supposed to be Bible scenes?
Oh, absolutely, Marcus. You know, it's so funny because I recently completed a series of lectures for the Great Courses. I think many of your listeners will be familiar with that. They put out lectures by prominent professors, and I was delighted and honored to be asked to do a lecture series. But one of the things I do is I show that our perception of life and times in Galilee is so influenced by Renaissance art. Renaissance and Baroque art, mostly Italian artists who, of course, created these scenes based on their own experience. And you see these people in these long flowing garments, you know. And the truth of the matter is that women in biblical times made all of their own clothing. There was no Target. There was no Nordstrom's. So it was the really the duty of the woman, among many other things, to work and create the clothing for her children, for her husband, for herself, using a very primitive loom. And I actually have a picture of a loom like that, and I describe exactly how that would work. And so when I see these biblical reenactments, you know, going all the way back to the great epics of the 1950s, they're a little off in that regard. Life in Galilee at the time of Jesus was hard. It was extremely hard. And that's basically one of the key messages of the book, because right before the ministry, Galilee was roiled by two major peasant revolts, peasants who rose up against the crushing tax regimen of the Herodians. King Herod the Great decided to exploit Galilee as a colony so that he could fund his big projects down south in Judea. And as part of that, his plan was to tax the farmers off their land so that all of these plots held by families for generations could be combined in what the Gospels call the estates. And these estates would now be run by stewards, another word that we see in the Gospel, rather than the original farmers. And the whole point was to create a huge surplus that could then be sold into the Roman economy of Emperor Augustus. If you don't have anything to sell, you can be part of the club. And that was Herod's goal. And as a result, that explains why the pages of the Gospels are filled with thousands of people who are dispossessed, who have no more possessions, who are hungry, who are sick, who are ill. Vast gap between rich and poor, very much similar to the way that we see in our own world today. And I think that's why the experience of his ministry is so relevant for us today. And that's basically what I try to visualize in this book.
So these were times where lives were disrupted with dispossession of property, with dislocation. And I would love for you also to say something about the mix of the peoples in the region. We're talking about the Levant in a time when there's an empire that has taken over. You've got Rome there and Herod, I guess a vassal king kind of a situation, and all kinds of people of different makeup, of different backgrounds.
Absolutely. And, you know, and in fact, the root of the word Galilee, Galilee, is in Hebrew, the world of the Gentiles, because historically, Galilee was very different from Judea. Judea was always the heartland. That's where the beating heart of ancient Judaism was, Jerusalem and Judea. Galilee was sort of up north, the sticks, and historically, it had always been permeated by lots of settlers from Assyria, then later Babylonia, a lot of foreign blood coursing through the veins of these people. So there was tremendous prejudice among Judeans against Galileans. And so when the Gospel of John, you say, well, what good can come from Nazareth? You know, the Messiah is coming from Nazareth. Are you out of your mind? And so that's something that Jesus really struggled with. And that's why you see in the original phase of his ministries, and one thing I try to do based on the historical evidence is sort of reconstruct the chronology of his ministry. You know, the Gospels are obviously based on oral traditions over many, many years, a generation of transmission. And of course, lots of stuff gets sort of mixed up. So what I try to do is really break down the chronology of his ministry, phase one, phase two, phase three. And you see that he slowly expands the ministry, first from his base in Capernaum, then to the surrounding villages. Phase two, he gets a boat, and now with his fishermen apostles, he can cover a much greater area around the Sea of Galilee. And in phase three, he discovers that there are Gentiles from Tyre and Sidon and Phoenicia and the other regions in Gerasa, which is today Jordan. They come and listen to him as well. He says, wait a minute, that's interesting. And of course, that's the beginning of early Christianity, the idea that a Jewish reform movement can ultimately become a redemption movement for all humankind. It's a fascinating story. And that's what the book tries to do. It tries to basically follow that development using lots of pictures and maps and all the wonderful things that National Geographic can bring to the table.
Now, I'm wondering if this is too sweeping a generalization to make, so you help me out with this. But I have this idea that with the socioeconomic and political pressures that you were talking about a moment ago, that you have people who are hurting and they're looking. They're seeking for a way out. They're looking for some kind of help. And I'm just wondering if society of the time among the lower classes was just ripe for a message like the message Jesus would bring them, and if their followership in some way can be contextualized with all of these pressures of the times.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. I think the ministry of Jesus was informed and shaped by the tremendous socioeconomic crisis that was taking place in Galilee. And we're only now beginning to understand the extent of that devastating impact of the Herodian regime. They didn't care about Galilee. Herod, earlier in his career, had served as governor of Galilee during the Hasmonean period. And this was a time when the civil war was raging between the assassins of Caesar and Anthony and other people. And Cassius, one of the assassins, asked Herod and his father to raise money so that they can develop new troops, new armies from the Near East. And Herod imposed such a crushing regimen on these farmers of Galilee that he raised an astonishing amount of money in a very short time. So fast forward 10, 20 years later, now he is king of this whole region. And he decides, hey, wait a minute, I can keep doing that, exploit, crush the peasantry of Galilee, squeeze them dry, take their land, and then use that to not only build these great cities in Judea, but also participate in the global economy of Augustus. And that's what shaped Jesus' ministry. And that's why the pages of the Gospels are full of these people who are hungry, their children, they're walking around in tattered clothing, they have no way to go, no home, no land. And that's the subject, that's the audience that comes and listens to his Sermon on the Mount. So when you hear him say, happy are you who are hungry now, because you will be filled, that's the context for that great sermon. Because otherwise you would say, well, that is a bizarre situation. Why would you be happy that you're hungry? Well, he's giving them hope. He's giving them hope because he's going to inspire Galilee to build a new society, a society that he called the Kingdom of God. And that's what ultimately would inform all of his actions for the remainder of his ministry.
Now that you have mentioned things like the Sermon on the Mount and King Herod, when we encounter those names, those proper names, you know, or those places or those people in the biblical account, how do you grapple with the gap between the accounts handed down to us as written scripture versus the historical record? Because who knows where that mount was on which that sermon was given? And who knows if three wise men actually came to Herod? How do you grapple with those kinds of disconnects or trying to look for evidence of any kind?
Sure. No, Marcus, that's a good question. The thing is that in terms of biblical exegesis, this is the scholarship that analyzes biblical texts. We've come a long way. That scholarship started in the 19th century, and we've got tremendous leaps in understanding the origins of the Gospels. You know, the Gospels were written not by eyewitnesses. They were written by scribes, evangelists, who lived throughout the Mediterranean basin, in Rome, possibly in Asia Minor, possibly in Alexandria. So they weren't on the scene, but at the same time, they certainly used oral witnesses in terms of the oral transmission, the stories that were circulating in the Mediterranean area for a long time about Jesus before they were committed to paper. And that explains the differences between the various Gospels. But when people sort of point to those differences, what I say is, but look at what they agree on. It's astonishing to me that documents that were written at least a generation after the Easter events could be so similar. That is, in ancient times, that is, you know, there was no internet, there was no duplication, there was no book printing. It was pure oral transmission. And I find it incredible that so much about Jesus has remained intact in those four very different documents. And it's true, Luke and Matthew probably were very familiar with Mark, the oldest gospel. And so much of what Mark says was repeated in their gospels. But there's lots of other material they use. There is this hypothetical document that we call Q, based on the word Quelle in German, which means source. It doesn't exist anymore. But with biblical exegesis, we've been able to reconstruct that document. And so we know a lot more about how these documents evolved. And even though there are differences, I think where they agree is where there is so much that is valuable. And in addition, of course, we have documents from Josephus, we have the Mishnah that confirm much of what these gospels are telling us. So overall, it's a fascinating mosaic, if you will, a texture of many different strands, but together they make a beautiful tapestry.
Jean-Pierre Isbaut is with us. He is author of The Biblical World, published by National Geographic Books, also the volume In the Footsteps of Jesus, a chronicle of his life and the origins of Christianity. We're going to come back to Palm Sunday, which I mentioned earlier, and talk about some events from the scriptural accounts closer to the time we celebrate as Easter. After a short break here on Constant Wonder, stay with us. Thanks for joining with me for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. It's our pleasure to be visiting with Jean-Pierre Isbaut. He's author of In the Footsteps of Jesus, a chronicle of his life and the origins of Christianity. You know, I want to talk just for a brief moment again about Herod. And there were multiple Herods, actually, Herod the Great and the other Herods, right? But when we look at this nasty man, because we think about, say, the slaughter of the innocents, you know, in Bethlehem, the little children killed. Nothing like that in records outside of scripture or religious documents.
No, that's true, Marcus. You're right. I mean, there is no historical attestation for the massacre of the innocents, which, of course, is very much inspired by the story of all the children being killed by Pharaoh in Hebrew scripture, and Matthew always tries to make these correlations. However, having said that, Herod the Great was an intensely cruel man. He killed many of his own sons, because he suspected that they were plotting against him. They may well have been doing that. We don't know. He created a police state where citizens were encouraged to inform upon each other. The country was a prison. He had built big strongholds all around the kingdom, both to keep enemies out and to keep his people in. One, of course, is the famous one, is the Masada stronghold that you can still visit today. And he was worried that upon his death, people would be celebrating. So he ordered a huge mass of people to be incarcerated in one of his large stadiums that he'd built in Jerusalem, with orders that if he died, all of these people would have to be killed so that there would not be any partying when news of his death spread. I mean, this is the measure of the man. He was a very, very bad person. He's known for all the great projects he built, the port of Caesarea, of course, the city of Sebaste in Samaria, and Jerusalem, of course, the second temple he built into the largest sanctuary in the world of the time, which is a huge achievement. But as a ruler, he was really a very bad man.
Yeah. So you wouldn't put it past him, the story about the infants?
No, even though historically, and we have details of his terrible misdeeds from Josephus, the Jewish historian, as well as others, and Josephus wrote for a Roman audience, you know, he had to be careful to make sure that he didn't say anything that was politically incorrect. But he absolutely does not hesitate to denounce Herod for all of the horrible things he did. But the Massacre of the Innocents is probably more seen from a symbolic perspective.
You know, I'm so interested in this symbolic thing because there's no reason, in my view, to downplay the power of symbol. You know, when you talk about the comparison between, say, Pharaoh killing the young children and then Herod perhaps doing the same, these parallels come back and back again. And it seems to me that Jesus' audience would have been very receptive to a plot line that they knew from their own history.
Oh, absolutely. And this is another wonderful topic because, you know, I just did a series of lectures for The Great Courses. Your listeners will maybe be familiar with that. It's a series of 24 lectures about history and archaeology of the Bible. And one of the things I tackle there is the symbolism in the Bible. For example, the idea that God created heaven and earth in 6 days. And, you know, if we were to interpret that in literal sense, that God created the world in 6 days, it would, of course, be difficult to reconcile that with what we know about science. And so we have this split in our country between people who want to interpret that literally or people who want to see it from the evolution point of view. My answer to that is, as I explain in the lecture series, is that we have to look at the meaning exactly as you just said. It's not that the Bible says, okay, now there were 24 days, 6 days, and he started at 6 a.m. And so, no, that's our 21st century mindset. We have to bring the mindset of the ancient times. And what Genesis is telling us is that it is God who created the universe. And the 6 days is actually largely inspired by Mesopotamian motifs. This Genesis originated in Mesopotamia. And there are many, many Babylonian, Mesopotamian tablets that talk about the gods creating the earth in 6 days. So what Genesis is, Genesis co-opts that story, but transfers it to faith in one God. And that is the meaning. It's not the 6 days. It's the fact that all of this earth, this beautiful universe, was created by one God. Not 20 gods, not 30 gods, by one God. And so we always have to look for the essential meaning of these stories rather than get hung up on the facts.
This is just like what you said earlier about you could focus on the disconnects between the Gospels, or you could focus on the connects and see how remarkable it is that there is consistency on certain themes and certain ideas.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is really remarkable that there is so much that we actually know about the time of Jesus. And that's what I try to do with this book, really pull all the evidence, the source documents that we have, even in areas that you would normally not look at. For example, I use Roman records of agriculture in Egypt just to show typically what a typical plot of a farmer would look like. You know, and the point I make is that Joseph was very likely a farmer who had a side business as a tecton, as a carpenter or skilled worker. Because look at the parables. Does Jesus, when he talks about the parables, which are so drenched in symbolism, does he talk about sawing or hammering or anything like that? No, he talks about seeding, the harvest. And he, as a child, he must have observed that, how you seed land, how you harvest it, how you cut the sheaves, and then you throw them up on the threshing floor to separate the chaff from the kernels. All this stuff clearly shows that Jesus was raised in an agricultural milieu. And so you bring these Roman documents in, and all of a sudden there is depth to the stories of the Gospels. And I hope that's what I will bring to your listeners, this sense of really being there with Jesus in first century Galilee.
I want to bring up a practice that was common across many cultures of the ancient world, multiple practices, I should say, and they could all be covered under the umbrella of augury or trying to determine what would happen in the future. And in the Bible, we come across things like drawing lots, you know, and I just scratch my head when I think about how I grew up with teachings of what might be the divine will for me in my life, or what the future might bring, or what a blessing might consist of. And then I start thinking of augury and fortune telling and seeing the future. And then I start getting kind of uncomfortable with aspects of what today I would consider the occult. And yet, could you address a little bit about what in Jesus's world people would have expected from the realm of seeing the future and prophecy?
Absolutely. I it's a great question. And last year I published a book called The Search for Heaven. And what I tried to explain in that book is that the world of Jesus was surrounded by supernatural phenomena. You know, we are so drenched in science and in our the comforts of our first world experience that we are just so invested in material things. We have lost the connection with our inner spirituality. Now, in Jesus's time, life was tough. You know, you couldn't go to Whole Foods and pick up some grapes. You had to cultivate it. And many times the harvest would fail because of drought or any other situation, or because the henchmen of Herod would take it away. So life was hard. And as a result, your spiritual self, your spiritual universe became a comfort, became a refuge. We have lost that. Now, the extension of that is that if you believe yourself are driven by your inner spirit, that the world around you is driven by spirit as well. And that's why we often hear of Jesus, talking to evil spirits, good spirits. And, I traveled to Bali several times, and that society still believes that as well. Everything is governed by spirits. We think it's primitive. We think it's really ridiculous. It is not. The world is driven by spiritual energies. I think that's a word that we would probably accept more than spirit. There are energies in our world, in ourselves, and in the world around us that we are only now beginning to understand. You know, Stephen Hawking, who was an agnostic, acknowledges that the universe is driven by energy that we don't really know yet, and we have to discover, hopefully, in the next coming century or so. Scholars or physicists call it the quintessence. All that brings me back to the fact that we may consider it silly, these supernatural phenomena, but I think these people are onto something, that they had a sensitivity for spiritual presence that we no longer have, and that we try to now recover through mindfulness and meditation and so forth. For people in Jesus' time, that was second nature. And so we have lost that a little bit, I think.
Second nature is a fascinating thing to think about, that people were steeped in their culture, their tradition, their religious heritage in such a way that every day when they awoke and saw the sun rise, they were just glad to be alive and maybe have something to eat. And the spiritual life was not just of interest to them, but probably was paramount.
Absolutely. Yeah, it sustained them. It really sustained them, the faith. And through all the hardship that they experienced in those first decades of the first century, it was that belief, that faith, that something better was coming, that hope was on the way. That's what Jesus gave them. And he tried hard to build that society. He didn't quite achieve it in Judea and Galilee, but he did achieve it. As future missionaries brought word of his teachings to the Mediterranean world and ultimately the Roman Empire, and the result is Christianity as we know it today.
I would love to spend a little bit of time talking with you about sort of the cultural collision that happens between the world of Jesus, the local world, the parochial world, and then that big empire, Rome, and it all comes crashing down in a trial. And we're talking about towards the end of his life then, of course, the last few days of his life. You've had a few things to explain about the nature of the legal proceedings for Jesus leading up to his crucifixion.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking that. You know, we are based on the Gospel of John, which is a beautiful gospel near the end of the first century. It was written, tells us this beautiful story of a trial. And we see Pilate really vexed by the innocence of Jesus. What can I do to acquit this man? Clearly he is innocent, but then he is forced by the hands of the Jews baying for his blood. It's a very dramatic story, but historically, it is very difficult to defend. And the reason is that Jesus was not a citizen. He was not a Roman citizen. Therefore, he could not petition to be governed or to be judged by the jus civile, the Roman civil law. As a colonial subject, he had no rights. And instead, he was his case was heard under the law called Jus Gentium, which is Latin for the law of the foreigners, which was originated in Rome and then used throughout the Roman Empire for anyone who wasn't a citizen. It was a very arbitrary set of rules. Basically, whoever presided over the hearing could do as he saw fit. And that's exactly what we see in the Gospel of Mark, the oldest gospel, very close to historical events. And Mark depicts it, I think, very accurately. Jesus is led in. Pilate asks, what's your story? What's the charge? Well, political sedition. Pilate says, do you have anything to add? Jesus is quiet. And he says, okay, then, off with his head. There's only one punishment for that type of charge, and that's crucifixion. The whole thing was settled maybe in 4 or 5 minutes. It's very, very sad. And of course, we'd love to imagine this trial to be a contest of different ideas and wills. And that's why I love that story in the Gospels, in John's Gospel. But historically, it was just a brief hearing, and it was already a foretold outcome. I mean, even before he went into the presence of Pilate, who was a very mean man, very tough, a very cruel person, it was a foregone conclusion that he would be crucified.
Just a bureaucratic transaction that is all in a day's work for those administrators.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, just a word or two, if you would, and I know we haven't got time for all that I'd like to hear from you, but the idea that from the life and the culture in which Jesus lived, then suddenly I can find myself one day in a museum looking at a Peter Bruegel's painting that depicts snow in Jerusalem, you know? And then there's this European kind of transformation of the trappings of Christianity and the Christian story, all on European terms. And this happens over and over and over again, where suddenly, by the time Christianity makes it to say, England, you have all kinds of aberrations in terms of what people think Jesus's life was like, because it's all in the trappings of, you know, merry old England.
That's right. You know, our idea of Jesus and the depictions of Jesus in religious paintings and prints is very much influenced by the Renaissance and the Baroque, which, of course, depicted him as a Caucasian with blue eyes and white skin. And that's how we imagine Jesus today. Of course, the reality was very different. As Syrians and Israelis and Palestinians today, and I've traveled there many, many times. I go there almost every year. These were people of color. So Jesus was a person of color. He had dark skin. He probably had a beard, as most Jewish observant men would have. He was fair, not very tall, maybe 5 feet, 5 feet and a few inches. That's about the average height of a person, as we can tell from the skeletons and skulls that have been dug up in that area. But a man of tremendous forceful presence. I mean, if there's one thing that you learn in the Gospels, is that when Jesus got into a room, he sort of, you know, it's sort of like electricity that permeated that room. You know, you sometimes have that people with sort of a glow around their head who command all the attention in a room. That's what Jesus was about. And I think that's why he had such a tremendous impact on the people of his time. And of course, we revere him as the Son of God. But I think as a his presence in life, in daily life, which I try to depict in this book, is what really made him so impressive. And his rhetoric was so incredible and so developed. And in his own way, he made a tremendous impact on the ancient world. And look, it took only 300 years for the movement of a poor local rabbi in Galilee to take over the Roman Empire. And that's a pretty impressive result.
Jean-Pierre Isbau, it's a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Marcus, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Jean-Pierre Isbau, author of The Biblical World, published by National Geographic Books, and also the volume In the Footsteps of Jesus, A Chronicle of His Life and the Origins of Christianity. Not far from the shores of Lake Galilee in modern-day Israel, a very ancient mural has been found. It depicts, among other things, Jonah, the prophet of the Old Testament, this poor prophet swallowed by a succession of three fish, what could that possibly mean? We're going to ask the expert who just recently found this unusual mural in a remote village. Constant Wonder will be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. In the region of Israel called Galilee, just 3 miles from Capernaum, where Matthew the Apostle lived and where Jesus did much of his own work, there is a heretofore little-known village known as Hukok that turns out to be a treasure trove of archaeology from the era of the Roman occupation. And among the stunning recent finds at Hukok were superb, colorful mosaics. To learn more, I had a chance to speak with Jody Magnus. Magnus is a professor of early Judaism at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she is director of the Hukok Excavation Project. Right now, we're going to join in with his conversation with Jody Magnus describing the moment of discovery when these floor mosaics first came to light.
We sort of thought that there would be mosaics at some point. We didn't know where they were coming from because we were finding lots of little mosaic cubes that are called tesserae mixed in with the dirt. But we didn't really know that the floor was paved with mosaics till we hit it. And what happened was Brian was hoeing through the dirt and he felt his hoe clink on something and he got very excited and he called me over and I took a little paintbrush and brushed away the dirt and we could see the face of a woman in the mosaic floor peering out at us through the dirt.
And you said?
Actually, everybody just came running at that point to look, and it was actually at that point we just shut the area down and called a site conservator to come because I'm not qualified to. Mosaics have to be uncovered in a very particular way. They need a lot of conservation. You can't just randomly uncover, you know, a 1,600-year-old mosaic. So we actually got on the phone with our site conservator, who wasn't with us at that point, and told her we had a mosaic emergency and she needed to come immediately. So she got there the next morning and uncovered the mosaic for us.
Was this the first?
And that's actually what you see in one of the photo that you mentioned is not that particular mosaic. The one you're talking about is an extraordinary mosaic from a couple of years later, where again, by this time, you know, we know that every time we reach a certain level, we'll have mosaics. We just don't know what they're going to be. So we all stand around and watch as our site conservator brushes the dirt away to see what's there.
Yeah, I've never heard the phrase a mosaic emergency. We have a mosaic emergency. That's new to me.
Well, it was actually new for me too.
When a picture first is brushed clean, and you say, well, there's a human figure, well, there's an animal, where there's a ship, there's a fish, whatever it is. When you first look at the image, do you even dare to interpret it or guess what it depicts?
Oh, yeah. Well, so we now actually do kind of play that game. You know, as the dirt is being brushed away, we all start trying to guess what it's going to be. And we don't award prizes, but we kind of feel like, you know, whoever guesses it right is the one who should win the prize. So the Samson and the Foxes was actually identified by an Israeli colleague of mine who was with us part of that summer, who has since passed away, David Amit. And he saw the foxes with the torches tied between their tails, and he immediately said, "Oh, that's Samson and the Foxes." And I'm like, "What's Samson and the Foxes?" That's not an episode that a lot of people necessarily pay attention to. But I have to say, I was the one who got right the parting of the Red Sea. I was the first one to get that one. So, you know, we kind of play that game now. You know, what is it that we're beginning to see as the dirt is being brushed away?
Yeah, well, these finds are just extraordinary. And we do want to talk about some of the images. You've mentioned Samson and the foxes. That's a biblical scene?
Yeah, nearly all of the mosaics decorating the floor are divided into panels. And the entire floor is covered with these panels. The overwhelming majority of them are biblical stories. And so we have two episodes of Samson and the Foxes, which is a story in the book of Judges 15, where Samson takes revenge on the Philistines by taking 300 foxes. He puts them in pairs. He ties their tails together, puts lighted torches between their tails, and sets them loose to burn down the agricultural fields of the Philistines. So that's one panel. And then the other Samson panel is from the book of Judges 16, which is Samson and the Gate of Gaza, where Samson goes to Gaza to sleep with a prostitute, and the people of Gaza decide they're going to ambush him when he comes out of the prostitute's house in the morning, but he fools them. He gets up at midnight, and he leaves the prostitute's house, and he pulls up the gate of Gaza, puts it on his shoulders, and carries it away. So we have Samson carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulders. And then we have a series of biblical scenes that include Noah's Ark, and where you see all the pairs of animals. And we have the parting of the Red Sea, which is actually it's a little bit of a variant on the story of the parting of the Red Sea. It's Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed up by the Red Sea, but it's actually Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed by giant fish in the Red Sea, which is an embellishment, of course, on the biblical story. And we have a depiction of the story of Jonah, which is the first time this story's ever been found decorating a synagogue, or it's actually the first time it's ever been found in ancient Jewish art. It was very popular among Christians in this period, but it's never been found in Jewish art. And it's also a variation on the story because it shows Jonah being swallowed by three successive fish instead of just one giant fish. And then we also have the building of the Tower of Babel, which is like a lesson in ancient building technology. It shows all the different kinds of building activities going on to build the tower. So, those are pretty much the biblical scenes. We also have some panels that we discovered last summer that are biblical. There's a depiction of the spies carrying the bunch of grapes between a pole, which is in the book of Numbers. You know, they're sent to spy out the fertility of the land. We have a passage from Isaiah, which refers to the end of days, where, you know, all the different kinds of animals will make peace with each other, and the little child shall lead them, and that's what's shown. And we have three ewes in a row who we think, even though the inscription isn't preserved, we think are the three ewes in the furnace from the book of Daniel. So we have a wide variety of different biblical scenes. We also have a couple of mosaics that are not biblical, one which might be the legendary meeting between Alexander the Great and the Jewish high priest, although everybody who sees it has a different interpretation. That's my preferred interpretation. And we have a heliozodiac cycle in the middle of the synagogue, which is a motif that's been found now in 10 different ancient synagogues in Israel. There's a whole story behind that. Why, you know, why would you find that in the synagogue? But at any rate, it's not unique to our synagogue alone.
I want to go back to Jonah and the fishes. I'm just hoping against hope that whoever uncovered that first uncovered Jonah's feet and then uncovered the first fish and sequentially suddenly said, but there's another fish swallowing that fish. And then there's another. I don't know how that happened. That would have been great fortune.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to...
Actually, that wasn't quite the way it went, but at any rate, yeah.
Yeah. Let's get to this difference between the biblical scenes and the non-biblical scenes, because I understand that might be at the crux of what's so interesting here in challenging some of our previous assumptions.
Right. Well, our synagogue has a lot of features that are different from most other synagogues in Israel in this period. So we have over 120 known ancient synagogues in Israel until now. Not all of them necessarily completely excavated, but that we know of. And when I say ancient, that means Roman, Byzantine, so we're talking basically first century up to, let's say, early 7th century AD. And the majority of them date to around the same time as our synagogue does. So you know, our synagogue is distinguished in a number of ways from most of the other synagogues, even of the same type in this period in Israel. As I mentioned, it's different in having panels with figured scenes, mostly biblical, decorating the entire floor. So most synagogues in this period, if they have figured scenes decorating them in the mosaic floor, it's limited just to the central part of the hall, what we call the nave. But our synagogue has them also in the aisles. All of our inscriptions so far appear to be in Hebrew, which is unusual. You would think that's not unusual, but it is, because most of the inscriptions in this period in ancient synagogues are in Greek or Aramaic, and Hebrew is rather limited. And then we have this, as you point out, unusual non-biblical scene, what might be the meeting of Alexander the Great with the Jewish high priest, or might be a Maccabean scene. Your own faculty member, Dr. Matthew Gray, who was my PhD student at UNC and is one of our senior staff members, prefers a Maccabean interpretation, for example. He brings students to be with us every summer. So having a scene in the synagogue that is not biblical is unusual. It's actually the very first time that an apparently non-biblical story has been found decorating an ancient synagogue. So there are other things too that are unusual. As I mentioned, we have these embellishments to biblical stories. There are a number of things that are unusual about our synagogue.
So what do you make of the fact that there are these non-Jewish images or illustrations, pictures that show up in the synagogue? Does this hint at anything conclusive about the way people were thinking in those days?
So first of all, I call it the Alexander mosaic, but we call it the elephant mosaic to be neutral, would be a Jewish scene. It's clear that scene involves Jews who are depicted in it. And even though the style is very fine, it doesn't actually contain a lot of images that you would think of as non-Jewish. But the panel next to it, which is a dedicatory inscription, this is actually the very first thing that we found, that Brian Bozong found, part of this mosaic. It has a Hebrew script and possibly Hebrew language dedicatory inscription in the middle that refers to the mitzvot, the commandments, which is a very Jewish thing. But it's surrounded by all sorts of weird Greco-Roman imagery. So there are cupids, there are Atlantes, which are the Greek mythological figures that hold up the world. There are what appear to be masks or possibly human faces in quatrefoils. And then in some of the other mosaics, we also have clear Greek and Roman mythological imagery. For example, the Jonah panel contains harpy sirens in it. Harpies are the Greek personifications of the storm winds, and sirens are, of course, those figures known from the Odyssey that, you know, attracted the, you know, these women singing that attracted the sailors. So clearly there are images in our mosaics that draw on, and then the heliozodiac cycle, which, as I said, is found in other ancient synagogues as well. So clearly, yes, there is Greek and Roman imagery. Were these Jews worshiping, you know, were these, like, as you said, syncretistic Jews who were somehow, you know, who somehow incorporated aspects of Greek or Roman religion into Judaism? I think not. I think one of the problems that I have with the way many people tend to look at ancient Judaism or study it is that they think of ancient Judaism or early Judaism, or in this period, especially rabbinic period Judaism, as somehow different and unique from everything that was going on around it. And I think part of the reason is because people tend to look at it as, oh, it's part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and they think of it like Judaism today. When in fact, ancient Jews were far more like everybody else around them, and they were doing things that were much more like everybody else around them, but that didn't mean they weren't Jews. So I don't think it's a matter of being syncretistic or anything like that. I think it's that the Jews are part of a larger context, and the problem is with the way we view them and not with what they were doing. They were, in my opinion, they were not worshiping these figures as gods. They were not, you know, the Cupids are not, like, for them, attendants of Dionysus who they're worshiping as the wine god or anything like that. It's just that they're drawing on the common visual imagery of that period. In that period, if you wanted to represent a storm wind, what did a storm wind look like? Well, it looked like a harpy. If you wanted to depict the sun, what did the sun look like? It looked like the figure of Helios, the sun god, in his chariot. If you were a Greek or a Roman, you worshiped that figure as a god. If you were a Jew, you didn't worship him as a god, but you still conceived of the sun as a man pulled in a chariot across the sky every day.
Yeah, this is just so fascinating. The mosaics, I have to ask just a few more final questions. How large is this, and how much of it is preserved?
Right. The building, the synagogue building, is about 20 meters, a meter is about a yard, 20 meters long and 15 to 16 meters wide. We've uncovered about two-thirds to three-quarters of it so far, so we still have pretty much all of the west aisle and part of the north aisle to go. And I would say we have about 70% of our mosaics preserved, which is actually pretty good. Not all of them are equally well preserved. The north aisle, for example, is fairly damaged. But, you know, there are substantial stretches of it that are very well preserved. By the way, let me point out that your listeners should not go running to visit Hukok. It's not open to the public. All the mosaics have been removed for conservation, and all the excavated areas have been backfilled. And once we're done our excavations, which will hopefully be within the next 4 to 5 years, we will then turn over the site to the Israeli government, and it will be up to them to decide if they want to develop it for tourism. And in the meantime, we will continue to work on publication and making the finds accessible to everyone. And you did mention your website. We have a website, which is just hukoq.org, H-U-Q-O-Q.org. And everything that we've published is up there on links, and there are photos and media links and stuff like that, too.
Two last questions. How many people would have fit inside the synagogue for their worship? Any idea?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's really a good question, and I should know, and I don't. And the reason I should know is because there was a former graduate student of my colleague, Eric Myers, at Duke University, which is, of course, just down the road from us at UNC, who actually did a dissertation and published it as a book on this very topic. That is, he took synagogue dimensions with all the furniture and everything, and he does calculations, and you can take his statistics and do calculations on exactly how many people could fit into a building like this. And to tell you the truth, I haven't looked to see what the calculations are.
Yeah.
But it'll be very easy to do. His name's Chad Spiegel, the
sure.
S-P-I-G-E-L. So somebody could actually take the book and then do the statistics and find out very easily how many people could fit into that.
The reason I ask the question is because if a very small congregation, you just can't imagine it having the money to put together such an elaborate floor.
Sure. Well, that's the thing. So it wasn't a small congregation. I mean, the building is actually a fairly large building. 20 meters by 15 to 16 meters is a pretty large building. Hukoq was a village. So one of the things I emphasize is that it is surprising to find a synagogue with this level of decoration and of this size in a village context rather than a town or a city. Hukoq was not a town or a city. It was a village. But it was not a small village. So just because it was a village doesn't mean it was a small village, and it doesn't mean it wasn't prosperous. Clearly, however, it was a larger and more prosperous village than we had previously known. Nobody ever heard of Hukoq, really. I mean, it's hardly mentioned in any historical sources. It was not on anybody's archaeological radar. Nobody excavated there before I started my dig. So it was just one of those things, and this is where we see the value of archaeology in supplementing information from, let's say, historical or literary sources. We wouldn't have had this information otherwise, unless we did the archaeology.
Jody Magnus, a professor of early Judaism at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's director of the Hukoq Excavation Project. Millions of us tuned in for the television documentary series about Vietnam, produced by Ken Burns. Well, the wealth of photographs in that series calls to mind a female photographer from the era, one of three women we're going to talk about next. They broke the rules to work as journalists in Vietnam. Stay tuned.